This podcast contains explicit language and detailed descriptions of bodily injury. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to the Coin Podcast Network.
I haven't done many interviews about those events. It still is pretty emotional and traumatic experience. There are some things that happen that I've kind of blocked out. And then there are some things that it feels like it was just yesterday. March 31st, 1989.
In the midst of a movement that will define a generation, one man's three-decade crusade for social justice takes him from the streets of Chicago to the National Football League. I'm Ian Costello, and you are listening to a special presentation from the Coin Podcast Network. This is the Andrew Sledd Story. AJ McCord covers sports, including the Seattle Seahawks, for Coin 6 News. AJ, we can list the names Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, Tamir Rice, Ahmaud Arbery, Freddie Gray, Sandra Bland, Eric Garner. We know these names because they died at the hands of police or were let down by the justice system. We know these names because they have become hashtags. We know these names for the wrong reasons. AJ, of all of those names, Andrew Sledd is not among them. Where were you when you first heard his name?
I was on a Zoom call with the Seattle Seahawks. I cover this team pretty extensively, and especially this year. But because of COVID, we no longer talk to players one-on-one as they're coming off the field or in the locker room after the game. Instead, everybody is on a Zoom call, similar to how the rest of the world is getting on with their meetings and business. And so I was talking with Seahawks offensive lineman Damian Lewis, and somebody asked him, whose name did you put on your helmet? Because the NFL is allowing the same thing the NBA did, which is that players can put the names of victims of police brutality or slogans such as Black Lives Matter on their helmets for this 2020 NFL season. So somebody asked Damian, whose name did you have in your helmet last week? And he said, I had Breonna Taylor. The follow-up was, are you going to put Breonna's name on your helmet this week? And he said, no, I actually need to talk to somebody to figure out how to get a name approved. I want to put the name Andrew Sledd. As you can imagine, in the Zoom meeting, a flurry of reporters instantly started Googling Andrew Sledd. And there wasn't much that came up. So before the press conference ended, I asked Damian, hey, would you mind giving us a little bit more info on who Andrew is? And he told us Andrew Sledd is his girlfriend's dad. He and his girlfriend Savannah have been together since their LSU days. They have a beautiful baby boy together named Damian Jr. And Andrew had an interaction with police in 1989 that resulted in him losing the ability to use his right foot.
So you hear this name, Andrew Sledd, that you'd never heard before, and you ask Damian about it, and he gives you a little bit of the background. What did you do next?
So I messaged Damian later that night, and I just said, hey, there's not a lot of information about Andrew's case. Would you mind if I called you to ask you some more questions? He said, actually, I'll do you one better. Here's Andrew's number. So I ended up calling Andrew the following day.
Hello?
And AJ, what did you hear?
Hey, it's AJ.
I heard a story I couldn't believe I'd never heard before.
Can you hear me?
I can. How are you this morning?
Great.
Andrew and I talked for more than an hour that first day. We met for socially distanced coffee a few days later in Seattle. I've talked multiple times since then.
His story begins around 10:30 the night of March 31st, 1989, when police served a warrant at his mother's home, where Andrew was living at the time while he attended St. Xavier College on a basketball scholarship. So the police had gotten the warrant the day before, thinking a man they were looking for lived there. He didn't, and they found Andrew instead. What happened after that is hard to hear, harder still to live through, because what police did inside that home on March 31st, 1989, altered the course of Andrew's life and his family's life forever.
And on that night, I was home with my girlfriend, and I was changing clothes because I was working part-time for a company, and I was working a night shift. And my girlfriend, she's a nurse, and she was working the night shift as well. So we were both kind of just relaxing, getting some rest before we both had to take off for work. I was preparing to jump in the shower and get dressed when I heard a tremendous pounding and banging on the front door of our house. And I started down the stairs to go see who the heck is kicking on our door like that. What is going on? I got about halfway down and the door flew off the hinges and just caved in, and the whole door frame just kind of crumbled. And when I saw that, I bolted back upstairs to my bedroom because I thought someone's breaking in the house, and this is we're in serious danger here. And at that time, I had a 22 target rifle in my closet that I would target practice with my dad in Montana, and I rushed into my closet to grab my rifle. And I was scrambling around trying to find it. And as I grabbed it, I turned out of my closet. There was a African-American man standing in my bedroom door with a gun in his hand.
At this point, Andrew thinks he and his girlfriend and his little brother and a babysitter are in serious danger. Maybe they're about to become the victims of a violent crime. He's got his 22 in his hands, and he finds himself face to face with another man who also happens to be black. AJ, what have we learned about this man?
We've learned that this man is a Chicago police officer. This African American is one of several that night who broke into Andrew's home, and all of the officers that Andrew later brought charges against were African American. So we hear a lot of stories about confrontations between white police officers and black people, but that's not always the case. Andrew even told me people have an idea in their head that these types of police brutality are always white versus black, but sometimes it's simply not the case. And this was one of those cases.
Skin color aside, Andrew Sled finds himself staring at a man in his home. And at this point, there is really no way for Andrew to have known that this person is a police officer.
Right. Andrew said at the time, and insists to this day, none of the people who stormed his house were wearing anything that could have identified them as police officers. And he even had witnesses, including obviously himself, the two women in the house, neighbors, who were ready to testify that they did not hear any announcement from the officers before they busted in the door. Now, we do need to point out that the officers involved categorically dispute that. They insist they shouted before they came in, and that they were wearing identifying insignia, like a badge or a hat. But keep in mind, this is late at night in Chicago in late March. So it's very possible if they were wearing jackets that could have covered a badge, or an insignia on a hat that late at night could have been hard to see.
Andrew says he has no reason to believe this is not a home invasion.
Correct.
And he saw me, and we kind of made a brief eye contact, and he took off running down the stairs, and he yells, "He's got a gun. Let's get the F out of here." So now I'm thoroughly convinced that these are some sort of home invaders who are in the house, and there's obviously more than one of them. So I kind of follow behind him in hopes that he's scared and he's going to run out the door. And when I got to the top of the stairway, gunfire just erupted immediately. And, you know, I cannot remember at this moment how many shots were fired, but probably close to a dozen. I would say between 9 and 12 shots, but I can't remember at this point.
Yeah.
And one shot hit me in the head. It kind of gouged out part of my scalp, and one shot hit me dead center in my very low abdomen. And when that happened, I kind of turned back and tried to run out of the stairway, and I collapsed. Mm. And what happened was the one shot that hit me dead center severed a nerve that controlled the use of my right leg and my foot. And so when I tried to run it, I couldn't, and I kind of fell to the ground. And then these guys, they rushed up the stairs, and then there were three or four of them. And they came up the steps and turned me over. And this one officer, he kicked me in my groin area. And then he kneeled on my chest and he put his gun to my head and he said, "I should blow your effing brains out, you." He called me another name.
AJ Andrew has been shot and badly wounded, and one of these guys is threatening to kill him. He still doesn't know who these men are.
No, Andrew told me, and this is backed up by what he said in court, that the first time they identify themselves as officers is after he has been shot, after he collapsed on top of the stairs, and after one of them is on his chest threatening to, quote, blow his brains out.
And then he said, "We're the police, you asshole." And I said, "I didn't know you were the police. I thought you were breaking into my house." And they kind of stood there for a minute. And I was pleading, "Please call an ambulance." And my girlfriend was still in the bedroom hiding. And they looked in the room and realized she was in there. And they whisked her down the steps immediately. And they kind of stood there looking at me. And then they asked me some questions like, "What are you doing here? What's your name?" Several questions like that, and I said, "I live here. This is my mom's house." And at that point, I think they were pretty quickly realizing that they had made a horrible mistake.
So, Chicago police officers in plain clothes bust down the door of the right house, but shot the wrong man, and now Andrew Sled is fighting for his life.
Right. And at this point, Andrew realized every breath was critical if he was going to stay alive. He told me he kept saying to himself, "You need to focus on your breathing. Otherwise, you're going to die."
And I was losing so much blood. I blacked out in the ambulance, and the guy in the back of the ambulance with me, he kept shaking me. He kept saying, "You can't close your eyes. You can't go to sleep because I won't know if you're dead or alive. So keep your eyes open." Blackout, come back, and then I can remember being put on the operating table. And there were like, out of 10 people probably doing things, "Where'd you get shot? And what happened?" And so I was trying to point to where I got shot because it's in a pretty private area. And then I can remember vividly, this nurse says, here's the hole," and she stuck her finger in it. Oh my God, I felt like I got shot again. It was unbelievably painful. And then I can remember someone saying, "Did you have anything to eat?" And I couldn't respond. And then they stuck a tube up my nose that went down the back of my throat, and it made me throw up. I was in surgery for 14 hours. The head surgeon told me later on in my hospital stay, I was in the hospital for a month. He said, no one would have bet a nickel that you were going to make it through the night.
For Andrew Sled, the night of March 31st, 1989, that began with plainclothes Chicago police officers bursting into his home, opening fire, and hitting him twice, ends with him in the hospital, where he survived 14 hours of surgery. He's alive, but AJ, his fight is just beginning.
And Ian, it's really continuing to this day. It started legally before he even woke up from surgery.
They were waiting there and waiting there and waiting there for the moment that I appeared to be awake.
Right there, AJ, he says they were at the hospital waiting for him to wake up. Who is this they?
The Chicago Police Department. According to Andrew, they were trying to get a statement from him while he's still fairly incapacitated and probably would have had his sister not been in the room.
Why does it make a difference to the police if Andrew Sled's sister is in the room?
As it turns out, she's an attorney.
We'll be right back. Hey, everybody. Executive producer Ian Costello here, coming to you from the Work From Home Coin Podcast Studios. When we started our podcasts back in February of 2019, we had no idea that we would end up here. Now, a year and a half later, tens of thousands of you are listening to hundreds of our podcasts, and we need to make some changes to grow even further. That's why, starting this week, you can find all of the Coin Podcasts in one place. The brand new Coin Podcast Network. From Beaver Smack to Writer's Block. From your weather to our constant coverage of the coronavirus pandemic and the protests in Portland. It is all available in one place. So, to keep hearing the podcasts you already love and to discover more of our exclusive audio content, head to coin.com/podcasts or search Coin, that's K-O-I-N, on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, Stitcher, or Podbean. Thank you for listening.
My sister, she was pretty much by my bedside as much as she could be.
So Andrew Sled is in the hospital after getting shot by Chicago police officers in a botched raid on March 31st, 1989. AJ, you said when he woke up after 14 hours of surgery that he found his sister in the room. And why does Andrew say that was so important?
Because his sister is an attorney, and Andrew told me she prevented police from questioning him while he was still incoherent.
And they wanted to take a statement.
Chicago and, PD?
Yeah. And my sister, he's not giving any statements. He's not able to give a statement. But eventually, when I was coherent enough, I said, you know what? I do want to give a statement. I do want to tell you exactly what happened. Because I didn't do anything wrong. They tried to twist it and turn it around, but my sister was there.
Ian, while this is happening, while Andrew's trying to recover from multiple gunshot wounds and has lost the use of his right leg, he's handcuffed to his hospital bed. He's connected to life support. It's not like he can go anywhere, but still, he's handcuffed.
There's a 0% chance that someone in that position is going to get up and leave. There's just no chance of that.
Y'all just shot him for no reason.
Emotions ran high after police fired at least 7 shots Sunday evening. Blake appears to have been shot in the back as he entered the driver's side of an SUV at gunpoint.
AJ, I gotta say that some of this sounds similar to the headlines out of Kenosha, Wisconsin a few months ago, where a police officer there shot Jacob Blake, a 29-year-old black man, in the back 7 times. He survived and wound up in the hospital.
It makes sense why that would come to mind for you, because Jacob Blake, while he was in the hospital, remember, he's paralyzed from the waist down, Police also had him handcuffed to his bed. So when it came up in my discussion with Andrew, I could hear some of his frustration that things haven't changed a lot in 30 years.
He's shackled, basically. You shackled a black man by shooting him in the back 7 times. This man is paralyzed, and you do that, and I don't know why you do it. And even if somewhere in the police guidelines it says an individual who's a suspect or in custody needs to be handcuffed to his hospital bed, the man is paralyzed. He's handcuffed pretty much for the rest of his life.
This video shows the moments after several bullets pierced the back of 29-year-old Jacob Blake Sunday evening in Kenosha, Wisconsin.
Unlike Jacob Blake in Kenosha in 2020, for Andrew Sled in Chicago in 1989, there is no cell phone footage of the shooting. There are no national news crews waiting outside of the hospital. No one is taking to the streets chanting his name. AJ, what's the next chapter of his story?
The next decade of Andrew's life is a blur of recovery, rehab, and exhausting court battles. Ian, I've been buried in these court documents since I first heard his name. After Chicago police shot him and almost killed him, prosecutors charged him with multiple counts of attempted murder and aggravated assault.
I mean, these charges come from the shooting when plainclothes police officers stormed his house?
Right. So remember that .22 Andrew said he grabbed out of his closet?
Yeah.
Police allege that rifle was pointed threateningly at them. Andrew strongly disputes that claim, but that's where the attempted murder charges come from. They also added drug charges for allegedly possessing both cocaine and cannabis.
That's a bit of a disconnect because, AJ, up until this point in time, we haven't heard anything about drugs.
So that's where it gets a little tricky. The night Andrew was shot by police, his mom came home and she found the house crawling with cops surrounded by crime tape the whole nine yards. She says she managed to get upstairs and runs into Chicago police officer Guy Lindsay.
He's the one who, when my mom went up the stairs, he pulled some narcotics out of his pants pocket and said, "I found these in your son's closet."
Ian, Andrew told me he's never done drugs in his life. He insisted then and insists today those drugs were planted.
AJ, let's stop there for a second because that's a pretty strong accusation. Police officers busting into a home and shooting a man who had a gun is one thing, even when we know Andrew Sled was the wrong man. Accusing them of planting drugs is another.
It certainly is. Again, Andrew told me he's never done drugs. Andrew's claim that they were planted stems from the officer his mom ran into when she returned home the day he got shot.
And that's Officer Guy Lindsay?
So according to court documents, he led the raid on the house the night Andrew got shot. And within 2 years, Officer Lindsay would be reported to Chicago police for cocaine use, test positive for cocaine use. He was suspended for cocaine use and eventually fired. So here's Andrew, a 23-year-old college kid on a basketball scholarship who had dreams of playing semi-pro basketball. Imagine how difficult this is for him, getting mistakenly shot by police, surviving surgery, and now facing what he says are trumped-up charges.
And now the actual court battle begins.
Right. First up was his criminal case, and this is another instance where his family's resources and ability to hire high-quality attorneys changes the game. It's an asset a lot of people in his position now don't always have, let alone back in 1989.
Fortunately, you know, my family, we have resources and we're very well educated, and we had an amazing attorney. And when we walked into the courtroom, you know what happened? Everything stopped, and the judge looked over at the clerk and said, "Call the Sled case." And we'd be there for 2 minutes and for status or something. And my attorney, they would say something, and then we'd be gone. And these other people with the public defender, they sat there. I was probably back at home, and they were probably still sitting there.
Andrew won his criminal case, acquitted on all charges, including those drug charges. But when we get to the civil suit he filed against the officers in 1991, things get messier.
How so?
Well, because Andrew felt like the four officers violated his civil rights, he filed a civil suit, accusing them of several things, including excessive and unjustifiable force and false arrest and imprisonment.
A civil suit in this case does make sense after he's cleared of all the criminal charges.
It does, but the case gets assigned to Judge Charles Norgal.
Why is that important?
Well, the legal team that Andrew was working with had previous dealings with Judge Norgal, and it ended with Judge Norgal being censured.
So Andrew tells you that Judge Norgal has a history with his legal team. AJ, for those who may not be fluent in the legal system, what does it mean when a judge gets censured?
A censure is basically a very, very harsh slap on the wrist. It's a formal way of saying this judge violated judicial conduct, but he doesn't lose his position or title. It does, however, put an asterisk by his name. Basically, it tells the public and other judges, hey, this judge isn't always playing by the rules and you need to keep an eye on him.
So it's probably safe to assume Andrew's attorneys and Judge Norgal were not on good terms when Andrew's civil suit began.
It's certainly safe to assume Andrew and his legal team felt that way.
He really was trying to make things difficult, just put us in the worst possible position in terms of bringing evidence and witnesses.
AJ, the case winding up in Judge Norgal's courtroom isn't the only reason Andrew says he feels that the deck may be stacked against him here.
Right. When Andrew's case reaches Judge Norgal's courtroom, Judge Norgal grants the city of Chicago's motion for a summary judgment.
And that's another legal term that people may not understand. AJ, can you explain in a simple way a summary judgment?
So a summary judgment allows a judge to say that all of the facts of the case have been presented. We don't need to go to trial, so let's save time and money. Filing a summary judgment is a tactic both prosecutors and defendants can use, especially if they think they may lose the case.
So the city of Chicago moves for this summary judgment. Judge Norgal agrees and, in effect, rules in favor of the city in Andrew Sled's civil case without a full trial or presentation of all of the facts.
Exactly.
So we were in front of Judge Norgal. The city filed a motion for summary judgment and he granted it. So that's the end of your case most of the time when that happens. And that's a historical thing that especially racist judges have done to people is just grant the city summary judgment and off you go, you know.
And this is when Andrew starts to realize how difficult this entire process is going to be to clear his name. He feels the system, from the police to the courts, is slanted against him.
I didn't do anything illegal, but had I not had the family structure that I have and the resources, you know, there's a good chance I would have went to prison. And that's a horrible, horrible thought and feeling when you didn't do anything wrong and you're facing prison time and it's your word against the police. If you read the facts of this case, you have to say, if you're a reasonable person, this doesn't smell right.
And what frustrated Andrew even more is the lack of media coverage, the lack of public attention his case got.
What was published in the newspapers was the police side of the story. Hmm. Not one reporter, not one person came to my family and said, do you have any idea what happened? How did this happen? What's your perspective? No one ever asked me. Not one congressman in Chicago or a senator or the mayor or a single official, black or white, said, Mr. Sled, this was a travesty and we need to do something to prevent these types of things from happening.
So Andrew Sled and his attorneys are hit with the summary judgment against him and in favor of the city of Chicago. What are his options?
He has two. He can either accept the ruling of the district court or he can appeal.
And what does he decide to do?
He decides to keep on fighting. 7 years after he was shot by police, his case winds up in the Seventh Circuit of the U.S. District Court of Appeals.
Took a long time to get there. What happened when it did?
He wins his case, essentially. While the appeals court didn't rule on any of the disputed facts of the case, like if the officers announced themselves before knocking down the door, if they were wearing any identification, if the drugs were planted. They did rule that SLED had produced enough evidence in the case that it shouldn't have been decided by that summary judgment. So they send the case back to district court and Judge Norgal.
So SLED and his legal team have to deal with Judge Norgal again.
They would have, but he and the Chicago police agreed to a financial settlement.
AJ, this would be a good time to talk about the Chicago Police Department and this story.
So we reached out to Chicago Police as part of our putting together of this story. They quickly responded to our email, directed us to file a Freedom of Information Act request, which would get us court documents.
We've already got access to most of those, and they did not give us any sort of statement about the case.
Correct.
So that's it then. That's how it ends.
Right. After nearly 8 years, the legal battle finally ends, but his personal battle, far from over. Since March 31st, 1989, Andrew SLED has had 20 more surgeries, a lifetime of rehab, and to this day, still does not have the use of his right foot.
And in many ways, Andrew SLED's story goes unnoticed and untold outside of his friends and family for the last 30 years.
Until now.
We'll be right back.
The Coin Podcast Network is your home for on-demand coverage of local news, sports, weather, and entertainment you won't find anywhere else. You can always find us on coin.com/podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
Just after midnight on March 13th, police shot Taylor at least 8 times. Killing her in the apartment she shared with her boyfriend.
AJ, there's a lot of aspects of Andrew SLED's story that resonate in a lot of the headlines today.
Right. You think about Breonna Taylor killed in her home in Louisville after police served a no-knock warrant. And we already talked about Jacob Blake, shot 7 times in the back in front of his kids. He's in a hospital in Wisconsin, expected to be paralyzed from the waist down, yet cuffed to his hospital bed.
When you talk to Andrew 30 years later after he was shot by Chicago police in a botched raid, do you get the sense of how he feels when he hears stories like Breonna Taylor's and like Jacob Blake's?
I think there's sadness there.
How so?
That as a country, we're still reading and watching stories like this. And I would also say there's a mixed bag of cynicism and hope of whether this current movement will lead to change. One reason for hope, though, is the device most of our listeners are probably using right now, their cell phones. It's a video recorder you take with you everywhere.
Because of technology, people who have never seen someone murdered other than a movie theater screen or on a TV show, when you see that in real life, it's tough to see. It's tough to watch, and it's hard to process. And I think that's part of the reason why we have more people seemingly involved in this movement than we have before, because they're actually the same people die.
I can breathe. Please, the knee of my dick. I can breathe here.
Obviously, the first name that comes to mind for most of us is George Floyd, who we saw not only die on cell phone video, but plead for his life for nearly 9 minutes earlier this year.
Right. And you think of the outrage, the anger, the demand for change that sparked worldwide protests in the middle of a pandemic over police brutality. Protests over the use of excessive force by officers. And the reason we all saw it was because of the bystanders who used their phone and recorded every second of it.
AJ, Breonna Taylor is dead. Tamir Rice is dead. Freddie Gray is dead. Sandra Bland is dead. Eric Garner is dead. George Floyd is dead. Andrew SLED survived being shot by Chicago police in a case of mistaken identity in 1989. And he has to feel that kind of sadness you mentioned over and over and over again. Did he give you any sense of where he wants things to go from here?
Yeah, and when you say the list like that, Ian, it's hard not to feel sad, right? Just at lives being lost. And he used this analogy to describe what we have at our disposal today that he didn't have 30 years ago.
I feel like in the past, we've had a boat
we've had a canoe at the dock, and someone is murdered, and people are upset about it. And we go to the boat and we say, this has got to change. We got to make a change. And to get there, we need to get in this boat and row to point B and start making change. However, every time we've gotten in the boat, we've had no oars. So we get in the boat, we're all angry, we're pissed off and upset, and we're hurt, and someone has lost a loved one. But we can't get to point B because no one has an oar. So we're stuck at the dock. And slowly we decide, oh, geez, we can't get to point B. We start bailing out of the boat slowly, and then it's back to an empty boat. I think now we have that same boat, and something has happened, and we've all run to the boat again, and we've said, we've got to get to point B. And lo and behold, we all have oars now, and those oars are our cell phones and our technology and Community X and Black Lives Matter and the NFL's participation. We got oars now, and I think we're going to get to point B. Now, when we get to point B, I don't know that we'll find, you know, a textbook of answers for these problems.
Obviously, AJ, most people are aware of the NFL, and most people know that the Black Lives Matter movement has been at the heart of the protests we have seen throughout this summer. I'm not familiar with this Community X Andrew mentioned.
So Andrew and his wife, Marie, who was his girlfriend at the time of the shooting, now his wife of 30 plus years, are now the proud parents of five beautiful children. His shooting incident happened before they were born, but eventually he told them about it. His oldest daughter, Chloe, really internalized her dad's story, and seeing him live with the effects of this for her entire childhood had a big impact on her.
Rightfully so. That kind of traumatic experience would have an effect on anyone.
Exactly. She was featured in an article several years ago where she says she remembers Andrew putting on a bulletproof vest under his clothes before he left the house because his PTSD from this experience was so severe. So she grew up, and the injustice of what happened to her father really stuck with her, and she wanted to make a difference.
When she graduated from college, she was hired by Google. So she worked for Google for a couple of years, and while she was there, she was still developing this concept of an app and how can we unite people across the globe together to share ideas. Like, you know, maybe I have a great idea about how to stop police brutality, and someone on the other side of the world has a similar experience and another idea. We come together. Now our two separate ideas become one stronger idea, and we meet another person. And so this app is an attempt to link people with like minds and similar interests and try to come up with solutions. And not just, you know, not just by protesting, but real solutions for real change.
And AJ, Andrew Sled has another daughter. We've already talked about her, named Savannah. Savannah brings us back to where this story all started for you.
Savannah dating Damian Lewis, rookie offensive lineman for the Seahawks, me covering the Seahawks this year. That's how Andrew Sled's story came across my life, and then by extension, the life of our listeners right now.
And now, AJ, we know this whole thing will culminate in a huge way when Damian and the Seahawks host the Dallas Cowboys in week 3.
So remember how I told you Damian wanted to talk to the NFL about what he would have to do to get Andrew's name approved and how he goes through the process of being cleared to wear it? Well, he went through that process ahead of week 3 against the Cowboys. And now Damian Lewis, as well as at least one other Seahawk, will be wearing Andrew Sled's name on their helmet on Sunday when they take the field against the Cowboys.
AJ, you found out about this story a couple weeks ago, and we've been working on it pretty hard since then. You got to commend the effort of Damian to get it approved and Savannah and Chloe. But have you come across something, or is there something out there that you think really sums up the fight of Andrew Sled over the last 30 years.
Yeah, so while I was getting to know Andrew and his family over a couple of weeks to share his story, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away. You think about the icon that she is, the way she changed the landscape of the law to be more equal, particularly for women. And you think that's what needs to continue to be done to change the system that allows things like what happened to Andrew, what happened to Breonna Taylor, Jacob Blake, and all of these lives cut short or traumatized by the actions of police. And the notorious RBG talked about what it takes to lay the foundation for enduring change that I hope, with this story today, we have lived out one step further. She says, quote, real change, enduring change, happens one step at a time.
Thank you, AJ.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Coin Podcast Network. You can listen to more great Coin podcasts on coin.com/podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Please listen, download, subscribe, and review.